I say this not only because it's the last commission meeting before Thanksgiving, but because I've seen firsthand during the last several months the dedication shown by both staff and by the commission. On your website are 60 sets of commission meeting minutes. I've read them and learned a great deal about the organization and the many hard choices that you've had to make. In 5 years, there's been 72 hours spent in this room during commission meetings. To prepare for these meetings, there's been over 4,000 pages of staff reports to read and review, along with other efforts to prepare for the meeting. As an indication of the importance of the work that you do during the past 5 years, there's been 38 Silicon Valley Clean Water staff members in attendance in this room, and believe it or not, over 100 members of the public as well. The work you do is deserving of an acknowledgement and appreciation. It's a big job, and I, for one, simply state it and say thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. No other members of the public. We'll move on to safety moments.
Today's safety moment, because Thanksgiving is coming up, is related to turkeys and safety tips related to storing turkeys, buying turkeys, cooking turkeys, and storing leftovers. So if you're into turkeys, you should read that and
very interesting.
Do it appropriately. Yeah, I thought there were some pretty good tips in there.
Through the chair, can I make sure you should add frying turkeys, because
ooh,
on the news,
turkeys.
We always hear some blow-up accident.
Yeah,
they're pretty big.
Probably suggest not frying turkeys.
I guess there's like some type of deep fryer you can put it in, and if you don't do it right, it blows up.
Thank you, Commissioner Lieberman, for your comments. Okay. Moving on to the manager's report.
Yes, manager's report. On the table that's in your packet, page 11, I just want to note, we talked about local limits, public hearing and adoption happening in December. We'll probably move that to January because there are some other changes that we want to make to the local limits, and we're still waiting to hear back from the regional board on their comments to our proposed changes, so just FYI. Also, a reminder that our holiday luncheon is coming up on December 11th. It's a Wednesday, so I hope all of you can make it. I think invitations went out a couple weeks ago. And I also wanted to just give a piece of information about something we do here regularly that I don't think the Commission's aware of. And we do what's called bioassay tests once a month. They last a week. And it's where we put the effluent in a fish tank and put trout, baby trout in there. We have a control tank and an effluent tank. And we have to have 100% survival rate of the fish throughout the course of the week. So everybody's always, you know, very careful. We try not to do major construction and take processes out of service. We just finished our bioassay last week, 100% survival, so we have a really good record. But I thought that would be an interesting factoid for the commission. That's all I have for manager's report.
Okay, thank you. Financial report.
The financial report this month, you'll see in your packets on pages 15, 16, 17 is the ordinary investment report. The only change that was made to what you're accustomed to seeing is on page 17, which is at the very bottom. Commissioner Audie asked that we add a line that reflects how much as a percent of our reserve target we are meeting, so I'm happy to share that, and that we are at or very close to our year-end targets, so by the end of the fiscal year, we will certainly be reaching those targets.
Can you remind us the targets?
So, those targets are, in dollar values,
And percent, yeah, or percent.
Yeah, so at the bottom is the operating reserve is about $3.5 million, so we've exceeded that because of interest earned. The CIP reserve is somewhere in the neighborhood of nearly $20 million, so we're nearly there. We have another 6 months of contributions to go, which is about $500,000. Capacity reserve, we don't have a target because that's as development occurs in your communities, those funds are passed along to SVCW.
Through the chair?
Yes.
And I should remember this, Matt, because I think I've asked this before. The last column on page 17, percent change versus prior month, that's what's driving that? Just distributions from the funds?
Those are mostly transactions. As maturities, certain securities have matured, some might be reinvested in the same type of security, others different. So depending on the month, you'll see a percentage change occur.
Okay.
Based on our strategies.
And that's why I presume at the bottom, well, let's see, the 0.9%, that's related to total investments?
That is just the money market line.
Oh, that's just the money market line.
Money market, yeah, comes in and out again as we have maturities occur. Some may be more or less in money markets.
All right, well, maybe I can talk to you about that offline. I want to make sure I understand what that means.
If I can offer a total, that might neutralize some of those discussions. You can do that.
Okay.
And then the quarterly financial report.
Thank you. Yes, on pages 21 and 22 of the package is our quarterly financial report. We are favorable for the first quarter of the fiscal year in expenses. Considerably favorable, almost $800,000. Much of this is timing, and that will be remedied by the end of the fiscal year. You typically see a slower start at the beginning of the fiscal year, and then it starts to take more shape in the third quarter and the fourth quarter of the year. I will say that a couple of lines, we are favorable, and that may continue. Utilities, we budgeted for a higher PG&E expense rate than we are incurring. And then some chemicals, we also budgeted for some higher chemical expenses, which were able to be negotiated out just as the beginning of the fiscal year was starting. So we hope to preserve some of those savings by the end of the fiscal year.
Through the chair.
Yes,
Commissioner. So, Matt, on the fourth bullet point down, the chemical expenses, actually, it references that most, or probably about two-thirds of the change was due to delayed implementation of a new thickening process. Is that related to the thickeners? Or what is that? I'm just curious about what it means operationally.
We are installing rotary drum thickeners, so a new form of thickeners, and there's a little bit of delay in startup. We just had some issues in the construction, so it started up now, but I think we're probably delayed a couple months on that.
Okay.
And so we used our old thickeners and our gravity bell thickener.
And the delays are not, those kind of delays are not indicative of some issue that has been uncovered that might affect other things?
No.
Okay.
So, through the chair, high level, my takeaway, and I'd like to just, am I right? High level, we're tracking reasonably well. We don't see anything on the horizon to be concerned about. All is relatively good.
I would agree with that. You know, two-thirds of our expenses is personnel costs. This is the first fiscal year of the new MOU that was approved, and we are tracking very closely to those numbers. That's the most important thing.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to engineering project status update.
I have no verbal report unless there are questions.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you for the report. And commission requested staff level action item.
Similarly, no verbal report on that.
Okay. And F, the rescue program status update.
Yes, I do want to point out that last month we were requested to put change order amounts on the report, which we did, and that's on, for example, on page 37 for front of plant, we have project changes box. And we as we're going through that exercise of thinking what's useful for the commission to see, rather than change orders that have already been executed, we decided for next month and then going on forward from there, we would put potential change orders. So what we see on the horizon, because we do see things on the horizon, and we could give you all a heads up. The risk of doing that is the contractor could see what we're thinking in terms of dollar amounts, and so that kind of takes away from our negotiating power. So we got to figure out how to manage those two things.
All right, any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question on the Gravity Pipeline Progressive Design Build Project. Mm-hmm. And it's really more just the potential issues box reminded me of something. So it references county permits and easements. And I was just curious about what's the latest in that saga?
You want to report out on that?
I don't remember the last time we reported out on this. We did meet with the county manager, had a good discussion. That was in early October, I believe. He said he would convene staff and have a meeting and come up with a plan for how to engage with us. And we've continued to follow up and haven't had a meeting yet, although emails are politely being returned saying, We know you're there. We haven't had a chance to meet yet, but we will get back to you when we do.
So we are still, I don't think this is too much, I mean, we're still moving forward with the work, obviously, but from the aspect of the approvals or acceptances or whatever you want to call it by the county, we're sort of still in limbo.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay. I'll just... That makes me nervous.
Yes.
I'm sure
it makes me nervous too.
Yes.
Very much so.
I'm going to share nervousness.
Yes.
Is there, this is not a topic on the agenda. I wonder if we should perhaps think about getting an update so we can discuss that.
We can put it on the next.
Maybe it'll be resolved by then.
Hopefully it will be resolved by then, but we'll make sure to put it on next month's agenda.
Thanks for bringing that up, Commissioner. Actually, I think the county's really playing hardball. It's happening in Redwood City with easements as well. They have all these pieces of property everywhere, and there's just got to be a new strategy, so it's not unique to this organization. We're facing it in other
areas.
Yeah, we've met.
I think it's something that we'll have to strategize and maybe use our political will, if those of us that can as well, because I think that's why we're here representing the commission, too.
Right.
So, yeah. Thank you for that update. Okay. Any matters of commission members' interest? Seeing none, I'll move on to consideration of the consent calendar.
Through the chair, I had a question on one item, and I wanted to pull for discussion another item.
Okay. Would you like to tell me those items?
I'm sorry, the item I had a question on is 7C, and the one I'd like to discuss is 7D.
Okay, we'll pull 7C and 7D. Any other?
Nope. In fact, I'll move approval of items 7A and 7B.
Okay. I have a motion on 7A and 7B. Do I get a second?
Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. 7C.
So this one I just had a brief question on, and that is the, I see the recommendation that's coming from the outside expert and from staff's expert is to use Microsoft Power BI, and I have no personal knowledge of any of these things. I'm just curious about whether or not there are issues even with going with that, in sort of a sense of what the trade-off is, because I presume other things were looked at.
Sure. So we are in, we just recently completed what I call phase two of the three phases of our new ERP. And that is a Microsoft product called Microsoft Great Plains or Microsoft Dynamics. And so it's a very robust accounting system. We've successfully finished all the core financials, general ledger, accounts payable, accounts receivable, so on. It's gone fairly well. Naturally, some bumps, but it's gone well. Phase two is work orders, and that's the operations of being able to work on equipment and keep a record of those tasks and those work orders that were assigned. So that's not complete, but it's active and live, and we're still fine-tuning that. Phase three is payroll. One of the things we learned when we went through this process of converting to our own ERP for the first time at this agency is that Microsoft Dynamics is a great tool, but it's not a good reporting tool. And we knew that going in. The consultant that we brought on to convert us, they knew that as well, and they recommended something that it's okay. It's kind of an old school crystal reports, like a lot of logic you have to build and language you have to write. Power BI is the next generation of, it's a visual tool, a reporting tool. So it's like access, but visually you can drag, drop, get the same field of data, and build your reports that much more quickly, resave those reports, convert those reports into Excel. It's all in the Microsoft family, and it's a very user-friendly tool that we've seen and witnessed and we're very excited about.
Okay, thank you. I'll move approval of 7C.
Go through the try. I have some comments on that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay.
Yes.
So by any chance, did you look at the product Tableau?
I'm familiar with Tableau, but not so much. I did not look at Tableau.
Okay. My experience, which is a little bit distanced, so it's not that I've used Microsoft BI. I've used Tableau a little bit, but it's more that I'm working with a lot of clients who are using it. What I hear is that they find it much easier to use than the Microsoft BI. I don't have firsthand knowledge, so this may or may not be right. Depending on where you are, and if you're comfortable with Microsoft BI and you think it's a reasonable thing, by all means, you know, I don't want to stand in the way of that. But from what I have seen from client presentations and working with it, I think Tableau may actually be a lot easier to use. I don't think it's as expensive, but I'm not really sure. Again, there are certain licenses where it's not expensive, and there are others where it's very expensive, but I think overall it still comes out would come out a little bit less. If you're at a place where it's still relatively easy to investigate the options, I would say it might be worth taking a look at before you make the final decision, and at least rule it out if it's not a good choice, because it might turn out to be better.
To add to that, I know we were looking at that in our at Kenyatta College as far as research and what tools to use. And I remember Tableau licensing was a little more expensive for our district to pay for. But and I know everyone was using it as well.
Yeah, and there were certain...
But there was a district, it's a state agency at Kenyatta College, so they have a limit on how many licenses and the other costs. So for our agency, it might be a little bit different, but it's worth investigating. So we had the same experience.
Yeah. And I know that they have a variety of plans, whether you can use it, whether you can read it, it's all different. And just because it's a reasonably self-contained, where I'm assuming the number of users is relatively small, yeah, I mean, that's why I say it's not that I know enough to kind of say, oh, it's a better option or not a better option. I just, I know it's one that probably is worth just being aware of.
Good. We'll certainly look into that.
Anything else on 7C? Now we'll move on to 7D.
So we left 7C.
There was a motion. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it sounds like is staff going to evaluate Tableau? I mean, I'll withdraw the motion.
I'm happy to have the motion and pass and have the funding there for it, so that you know, in the sense of giving them the option and doing whatever they think is necessary.
So I guess I would amend my motion to basically say that it's as written, with the caveat that staff is authorized to look at Tableau as a research and look at Tableau within the same budget constraint.
Okay.
I'll second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion Passes. 7D.
So 7D, the one question I had about that is actually it pops up at the bottom of the first page of the staff report, which is I'd like to understand, and I don't remember this coming before us, and that may be a failure of my memory before, but I want to understand the policy structure under which staff can make determinations that we don't need to put things out to bid. Because just as an aside, I mean, as a sort of this public policy thing, that was like, wow. Not that I don't trust staff, but it's just like the whole point of bidding processes is there's a whole bunch of public policy value to that. I'm trying to understand what the policy framework is that allowed staff to make the other determination.
Christine tells me it's legal to do, we can do it. But, I mean, fundamentally, from a technical standpoint, we look at the projects and the not only the complexity but the unique nature of the construction. In this case, we're getting equipment, in-kind services, equipment from a lot of different suppliers, manufacturers and suppliers. So to a certain extent, we don't quite know exactly what's going to show up on site. So we need a contractor who has a vast technical capability to put together different pieces of equipment, and we don't have necessarily 100% design documents that we could put out on the street for bidding, nor would we through the course of this. Because it is a research project, we do have the capability of picking the correct contractor for the job. So that's kind of where we came at it from a technical standpoint.
So how does that play into financial exposure? If, for example, if we approve this moving forward, and as you said, this is a research project, and we get partway through it, and we go, gee, this looks interesting, but it's going to cost twice as much as what we thought. What happens? I mean, but part of the benefit of the contracting and bidding process actually is to lay out the documentation, which I understand can be hard to do in a research project, but it's to guard against that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, this is more in the vein of a design build. So the contractors that we reached out to, Shea Parsons and Monterey Mechanical, one we've worked with a lot, and they're very fiscally responsible. We have our construction management team that's checking all their numbers as well as their payroll. So they've looked at the job, they've looked at what is involved in it, and we have an agreement with them. If they go over that, they have to do the work for the amount that they said.
Okay.
So.
All right.
Any other questions on item 7D? Can I get a motion?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Yes, me.
Opposed?
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
All right. Moving on to item 8A, consideration of resolution approving update. Silicon Valley Clean Water Investment Policy Guidance.
Guidelines. This is Matt's presentation.
Thank you. So the investment policy, this is something that we look at annually. Make adjustments for policy every year. The last time we looked at this was in June 2019, based on some of the recommendations from our newly retained investment advisor, who's here today and will be presenting. And that was mostly to get us to incorporate like government code changes and other things that had taken place since the last time we had updated the policy. Today, the policy discussion in front of you is really two parts, one small part and one bigger discussion. The first small part is that we as SVCW staff felt it was appropriate to have some language that would help us in the future selection of investment advisors. And that is to restrain or restrict the selection to investment advisors who have government experience, have substantial assets under management, and we felt that was important just to make sure that future decisions incorporate that. The second discussion is about the types of investments that we allow or disallow in our policy. To date, that allowance has been fairly conservative, and after consideration from our investment advisor, we would like to offer that discussion to say perhaps we should expand the types of things that are allowed to be invested in. We did bring this to our members' finance and technical committees in October 15th. We had a very good discussion, very lengthy discussion on this. And there is a divided sort of philosophy at times on this. And it's a question of risk versus yield and what is appropriate. We do want to emphasize that we as an agency always want to have safety first, liquidity for our needs, and last but not least is the yield element of that discussion. So I'll introduce Leslie Murphy. Leslie is here from PFM. They have been retained to manage our investments since July, and so she's a senior managing consultant with PFM. She has a lot of experience in this domain. One of the agencies that she is, where I met her actually, is with CSRMA, our self-insurance pool that ourselves in West Bay participate in to insure our assets. And so she manages those funds as well. So I'll turn it over to Leslie and let her discuss. And if you'd like to go forward, it's this button, shot, or just give me the
high sign. You have to do it from the keyboard, Matt.
I'll do it from the keyboard. Here we go.
Okay, well, good morning, everyone, and thank you, Matt, for the nice introduction. I'm really looking forward to working with you all. Maybe the best place to stand. Maybe up front. As Matt mentioned, we've been working together on the operating fund side since spring or early summer, so I'm looking forward to continuing that and happy to meet with you all today. So just a little bit of background information about my firm, PFM Asset Management. We have been managing public agency funds for 39 years. And I will say what sets us apart from some of our competitors is the fact that this is our core focus, managing public agency funds. We currently have about $140 billion in assets under management or advisement, and of that, all those funds are institutional. The vast majority, about 80%, are public agency funds. The rest are nonprofits or other long-term funds like pensions. We've been managing public agency funds in California for about 30 years. So this is really kind of the core of what we do. I work out of our San Francisco office. We also have a Los Angeles office, as well as other offices throughout the U.S. So because the bedrock of our business is managing public agency funds, our philosophy aligns with your philosophy, which Matt just touched upon, of safety first, and then liquidity, and then return. So our goal is to actively manage your portfolio within the parameters that we're going to establish in your investment policy in order to meet those three objectives. So, what is the investment policy and why are we talking about it now? Well, the investment policy is really the strategic guide for the oversight and management of your investment program, which is why we've spent such a long time kind of working on it. As Matt alluded to, we did make some recommended changes back in June, and now we're talking about it again now in terms of expanding your permitted investments. Your investment policy is a highly customized document, so there are, as Matt mentioned, some areas that staff recommended that we add to your policy. So the goal of an investment policy is that it's specific enough to provide the guidance for managing your funds and to provide direction to me as an outside investment manager, but you also want to have enough flexibility in order to take advantage of market opportunities within the constraints of California government code. So how will we meet your investment objectives? Well, again, your number one objective is safety. We'll achieve that through investment in high-quality securities, diversification across sector, issuer, and maturity, and continuous monitoring of the creditworthiness of all the securities in your portfolio. Again, because this is what PFM focuses on, we do have a dedicated credit committee and a lot of credit research analysts really looking into the financials of all the companies that we would use to invest your portfolio in. Secondarily, liquidity. We want to make sure you have adequate funds liquid to meet known and potentially unforeseen cash flow needs. So we'll coordinate cash flows with Matt and his staff and at the onset of our engagement, we did perform a detailed cash flow analysis to determine the amount of funds that should be kept liquid versus the amount of funds that can be invested longer term in the managed portfolio. And we also make sure that the securities that we buy for you do have an active secondary market, so that if you do need to liquidate funds from your portfolio, we could easily do that and raise cash for you. And our third objective is return on investment. So within the first two parameters, we will look to maximize the investment performance of the funds that you have invested with us. We'll do that through active trading and continual monitoring of relative value amongst all the sectors that you're permitted to invest in per your investment policy. So with that said, kind of just an overview of some of the investment policy recommendations that you've made, that we've made to you and that you've so far accepted. In June of 2019, some language regarding the use of an investment advisor, updating some references to California government code. This one I think is important. We established a 5% per issuer limit on non-government securities. So for example, if we really like Microsoft, well, we can't put all of your money in Microsoft. We can invest no more than 5% of your portfolio in any one issuer, which we think is a very good tool for managing that credit exposure and for also forcing diversification. So we made that recommendation back in June. And we also had some other recommendations regarding this purchase and sales of securities on a competitive basis and allowing for the purchase of certain government obligations and maturities in excess of 5 years. So now we're recommending you consider expanding your universe of permitted investments within the constraints of California government code, and we'll kind of talk through what that means. And just kind of as a note, as Matt mentioned, we did bring this to the commission back in October. There was a little bit of a divided response the working group back in October. There was a little bit of a divided response, so we actually kind of curtailed some of our recommendations and are recommending a smaller allocation to some of the sectors. So to kind of help to frame the discussion, let's take a look at what you are permitted to invest in per California government code. So because these are public agency funds that we're investing, California government code has a lot to say about what you can actually invest in, and appropriately so. So if you think about this as the entire universe of permitted investments, the area that you can invest in is very narrow, limited to only the very most highly creditworthy types of obligations, and there also are restrictions regarding creditworthiness and maximum maturity. So if you think about the entire investment universe, the slice that you can invest your public agency funds is already quite narrow, as appropriately prescribed by California government code. So, you know, kind of why are we talking about this? What are some of the benefits? Well, what we're showing here are the benefits of diversification, again, within the constraints of California government code. So the way to kind of read this chart is it looks at diversifying a portfolio over time. So the past 10 years, if you would have had just a 100% treasury portfolio, your total return would have been about a 1.68%. Moving up, if you were to add treasuries, agencies, and supranationals, so things like issues of the World Bank, you'd be at a 171, and so forth. So again, kind of the benefits of diversification are that you kind of expand your investment set, and over time, a greater diversified portfolio will give you a greater total return, resulting in higher interest earnings. So this next slide shows kind of a snapshot of your investment policy compared to California government code. So the way to read this bar chart is that kind of the yellow squares with sort of a star pattern in the middle, these represent California government code limits. And then the blue bars represent your investment policy limits. So most of the sectors, your current policy permits. But the ones that we're going to focus our discussion on today are commercial paper, negotiable CDs, asset-backed securities, and supranationals. Those are sectors that are permitted by California government code and used by most public agencies throughout California that are using an investment advisor, but they're not currently addressed in your policy. So this chart is kind of a lot of information going on, but I did just kind of want to pull out, you know, really kind of what we're getting at. What are PFM's recommendations? So this chart lists the different sectors permitted by code, the code permitted maximum allocation, your current maximum allocation per sector and per issuer, and the next column is PFM's recommended allocation, rating requirements, and PFM's recommended rating requirements. So the first I'll draw your attention to is that municipal line. So per California government code, you can invest in local agency municipals here in California and other statewide municipal obligations. Well, code would permit you to invest all the way up to 100% of your portfolio in municipals. We don't think that's a good way to appropriately use this sector. We don't think that's a good diversification. So we would actually recommend a 30% maximum allocation per sector and a 5% maximum allocation per issuer, again, to kind of control that credit risk. The other four that we have highlighted at the bottom are the four sectors that I alluded to earlier: commercial paper, negotiable CDs. Now, just to kind of be clear, these negotiable CDs actively trade on the secondary market. So unlike FDIC insured CDs, there's not the insurance backing them. Rather, it's the creditworthiness of the issuer. So they kind of look and feel a lot more like corporate notes. Asset-backed securities and supranationals. So supranationals were added to California government code back in 2015. They're all AAA rated, and they look and feel similar to federal agencies, but they're obligations of parts of the World Bank Group and also the Inter-American Development Bank. So we'll focus in on these four sectors. So for example, for commercial paper, code would permit you to invest up to 25%. We're recommending just a 15% allocation at this time, and again, that 5% maximum allocation per issuer. For negotiable CDs, code would recommend a 30% allocation. We are recommending a 15% maximum allocation, and we are recommending a single A credit rating. Interestingly enough, code does not require any credit rating on negotiable CDs, but again, we'd recommend tightening up the parameters a little bit and applying a single A minimum credit rating. Similarly, for asset-backed securities, code allows a 20% maximum allocation. We're currently recommending a 10% max allocation, and we're recommending a AAA minimum credit rating. Code requires just a AA minimum credit rating, so again, a little bit of a higher standard. And for supranationals, code allows up to 30%. We're recommending a 15% allocation. So if you were to approve the investment policy changes as written, that wouldn't mean that we would necessarily liquidate all of your holdings now and go all the way up to these maximum allocations on day one, but rather it would give your portfolio manager, within the guidelines of our fixed income investment committee, the flexibility to, when he sees issues pop up that he thinks offers good relative value, to start exploring these other sectors. And what you should expect to see over time are higher interest earnings. So that's kind of the conclusion of our recommendations, and this is sort of the summary page here. If you do have, I think in your agenda packet, there was also an appendix with more information about each of the individual sectors. But in the interest of time, I won't go over each one in granular detail, but happy to entertain any questions.
Yes, Commissioner Olbert, and then Commissioner Boudin.
Just as a heads up, I have a number of questions, so maybe you want to do like a couple and then rotate so that no one person is...
Go ahead, okay. Commissioner.
First question is, thank you. These aren't all for you, but some of them are for others. I would be interested in knowing what the finance committee or whoever you brought this to before... I'd like to have more color on the breadth of their feedback, because obviously there were several references made to it being a multiplicity of viewpoints that caused some changes, and I'd like to understand what those multiplicity of viewpoints were.
Sure. We made more or less the same presentation for the same reasons. And there is a certain amount of history in the state of California during certain downturns where agencies have lost principal. And at the end of the day, the points were made, why bother, right? Why try to increase your earnings if you're going to increase your risk? And I think there's a balance game there. You know, I do think that if you left it to me, and I'm not an expert in this, I would have the most conservative portfolio you can imagine. Bringing on PFM with their expertise and the fees we pay them, which are fair fees, I think, they're very good at this, and they have my fiduciary interests in mind, and they are very good at this, and they've proven that. So the discussion became for a few $100,000 of yield, would we want to have that increased risk? I still feel it's worth pursuing and worth discussing within the parameters of safety and liquidity. I don't think we should ignore yield and just simply put it in LAIF or put it in the county pool. LAIF in the county pool also has to diversify, and I'm not visible to, or at least I don't pay a lot of attention to what they do, but they will have the same tactics as PFM.
Thank you. What was your, it may have been none, your firm's involvement with San Mateo County back in 2008?
That predates me a little bit, but to the best of my knowledge, we were not involved with the county at all at that point. We were hired kind of after the fact on a non-discretionary kind of consulting basis, and then I believe now we are taking a more active role with the county. But to the best of my knowledge, we were not involved in San Mateo County in 2008. And specifically, I can tell you that we at PFM, we have never lost a client's principal due to issue or default. So at the time, I think it was a Lehman note that was in the county pool that kind of went belly up. We did not have any investments in Lehman.
Good, because I'm glad for that answer, because otherwise that keeps me from having to say that we need to get a different advisor. this last question, but I have some others, but I want to be fair to my colleagues. You touched on a little bit, but I wouldn't mind a little bit more color on what did happen with the portfolios that you were managing for agencies during the crash and Great Recession in 2008 and shortly thereafter.
That's a really good question, and I will say we took a lot of kind of preemptive measures. For example, we were buying certain types of asset-backed security commercial paper in some of our pooled funds. And well in advance of when kind of the market turned, the head portfolio manager who's been doing this for about 30 years, he just said, you know what? I'm not comfortable. I don't like the way that things are going. I can kind of see the writing in the wall. Let's sell out of all of our positions now, and then we'll be in the clear. So that's what we did. So there were no client loss of principal because of kind of some of that preemptive action. And I will say there was some further action in probably September, October, don't quote me on this, of 2008. We halted all credit purchases altogether just because the markets were really kind of overreacting, we thought, and we didn't want to get our clients' money kind of caught up in that. And I will say that because of our very conservative nature and the fact that we fully protected all of our clients' principal, our assets under management actually grew during that time period. We had some migration from clients moving from other advisors who were maybe a little bit more troubled, kind of moving over to PFM. So our assets under management did continue to grow.
Okay, thank you. I'll yield the time and come back later.
Commissioner Bigley.
Thank you. So first of all, thank you very much for the presentation. I'm with the city of Belmont, and I believe we use PFM for certain, not for our investments, but for certain other investment guidance, and PFM has had a very good reputation, and has been a very good company to work with, so I'll start there. How would you describe the difference between if Silicon Valley were to use PFM for investments and alternatively just use the state of California's local agency investment fund, LAIF, for its investments? Is there much of a difference?
There is, and there was a page in your appendix kind of detailing.
They don't have the appendix.
That didn't get printed up.
Oh, gotcha. My apologies. So then I will kind of speak from memory. I think that LAIF is a good product. And I think for agencies who have, let's say, a smaller asset level, or so that, you know, it doesn't make fiscal sense to hire an outside investment advisor, I think it's a good option. A lot of our clients do still use LAIF for liquidity. But I will say that because LAIF is managed to give you that daily liquidity, in general, kind of the maximum maturity is a little bit shorter than what you could do in your own individual portfolio. And because In most market environments, other than the inverted yield curve environment, longer-term investments typically offer a higher yield. You'll be able to get earn more than late by investing this way because we can invest funds longer for you and at higher yields. And also using PFM versus LAIF, you have that customization. You know, LAIF is kind of, it is what it is, and you invest in it or you don't, but you don't always necessarily see the underlying details, and you don't really have a chance to raise your hand and say, hey, I don't think we should be buying this.
So roughly speaking, how much are we talking about investing annually?
I mean, we have around $30 million, including our three reserves of operating reserve, CIP reserve, and Stage 2 reserve.
Okay.
And those amounts will be growing over time.
Okay. And I don't know if the slide that we saw completely translates to this, but in the different investment alternatives, I think it was about 0.5% difference between the most total return and the least total return. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to assume that LAIF would probably be somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, LAIF would probably be somewhere around here.
Okay. So if I've got it right, if we could get 0.5% benefit off of $30 million a year, am I right? That's about $150,000 a year?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And what are we paying PFM?
You're on a sliding scale of fees. It starts at 10 basis points for the first $25 million and then drops to 8 basis points.
I'm sorry, 10 basis points?
For the first $25 million and then it drops down to 7.5, I think, actually. Matt's a good negotiator. 7.5 basis points below that.
So for $25 million, what is 8 basis points?
Well, I would say that turns into 0.042, say, times $30 million. I see where you're going.
The net.
$126,000 of earnings.
In net benefit after PFM's fees.
So tell me we're not talking $24,000 a year. I mean, if we're paying PFM
I'm sorry. The 24 is their fees. Net of their fees is around $126,000.
Okay, so we're talking about $126,000 benefit.
Right.
That makes a little more sense.
Net of our fees around $25,000.
Perfect. Okay.
A little bit more.
So now I have another question. So by the way, you stop me at any point because I will also happily cede the floor to other questions.
Okay.
I'm like having a fun story right now. If we're going to pay PFM $26,000, it strikes me that to do the kind of thing that you're talking about and to make sure that we don't get upside or downside on principle, somebody needs to spend quite a bit of time actually thinking about the investments, doing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that suggests to me there are one of two practical ways that this happens. One is we are in a basket of companies whom somebody is managing together, so we're kind of being managed group-wise the same thing as a bunch of other agencies. Because it's hard for me to imagine that at $126,000 a year, somebody is spending a good portion of their time really worried about what we're doing. So can you give me a sense of how that happens?
And you're right. There's not someone managing your portfolio kind of in a bubble, nor would you want that. You know, you have the benefit of a fixed income investment committee. So the fixed income investment committee sets the parameters for all of our portfolio managers. And then within that, our portfolio managers are working to add value to your portfolios based on your strategy and your investment policy. So there are certain kind of high-level parameters, and there's also a lot of compliance monitoring and trading platform monitoring as well. But I will say that, you do get the economies of scale. And I'll give you an example. A lot of these new issue federal agencies or new issue supranationals are way oversubscribed. That means there's a lot of investors trying to pour their money into those very high quality distributions. So what we can do is we can kind of allocate all of our clients' investment and kind of do a block order. That way, even though Silicon Valley, you might have a total of $30 million, well, when you look across our entire platform, you know, well over $100 billion in assets under management. If it works for that client portfolio, we will put it together as a block order so you get that benefit of the economies of scale.
Thank you, and I think I misstated something, so I just want to correct it for the record. It's not that we're paying $126,000, we're paying $24,000. So, yes, that's where we're paying for a small percentage of somebody's time so that it has to be managed in a group, which brings us back to kind of like the LAIF model, albeit they may have a different viewpoint on the length of securities that they're willing to buy. So I will stop there for the moment. I do have more information after talking to our finance director over the weekend about this, but I'll stop and maybe come back with some more questions.
And I'll offer just a small thing, I'm sorry, if I may, is that we're also trying to set the policy for the next decade. We do see our reserves growing up to $50 million for our capital improvement program's future. And the numbers you speak of are still accurate, but that will grow to a benefit of, you know, $250,000 each year, every year, compounded over a decade. So it begins to begin real money to me, and I'm not being facetious, but it is something that I want to make sure that we weigh, you know, properly.
And just so you know, actually, I think what you're doing is very reasonable. Mm-hmm. I have certain concerns about it, and I doubt that I'm going to be able to support it. But I do believe what you're doing is reasonable in terms of strategy and direction. I just don't happen to agree with it.
Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Grotto. Yield it back to Commissioner.
Oh, I'm sorry, George,
you have... Okay. We're good.
I wasn't sure about the hand signals there. Let's see. This is probably a Matt and Teresa question. When I was going through this stuff, it seemed to me that, you know, our investment policy guidelines, they're based on the concept of looking at the portfolio as a whole, okay? I'm going to give you a little bit more context. San Carlos happens to be in a enviable position of, I think we had another banner year last year. We're going to have like $9 million in surpluses, and we had $7 million the year before, and we've got, despite the fact that we keep spending money on significant things, we have, you know, close to probably $30 to $40 million in reserves, which is about an entire year of our general fund budget. And so one of the discussions I've been teeing up with people is when you're, like in my personal investing, I always tend to look at the investment horizon. So I'm looking, I have sort of different rules for the portion of my portfolio that I'm looking to tap in the next few years, whereas the stuff that's I'm not hopefully going to need for 15 years, that's a different set of rules. Do we do anything like that, or is it?
We do.
Is it okay? Can you explain a little bit more about that to me?
Sure. We have three separate reserves. One is an operating reserve, and
right,
that's quite liquid. We would want that to be available anywhere from 6 months to a year, maybe two at the most, available to us because something breaks, something unexpected occurs. We need that money now. So that's our operating reserve, and that's around $3 million.
Okay.
The capital improvement program is money that we hope not to spend for the next, you know, decade or 5 years at the least. So we give that a longer maturity type of goal for Leslie and her team to manage. Those are things that eventually that capital improvement program will be there for a significant event. In the event of a catastrophic failure of a pump station, for example, and we'll touch on this in the next agenda item, those are funds that would be available. By the time you mobilize, get all the contracting in place, you would be able to hopefully liquidate that in 6 months to a year, but you're not going to expect to need that money, you know, any given day. And the third one is stage two, and that's around $13 million. And that's money that as your connections in your residence, in your homes, and your businesses connect to the system, they pay a connection fee. Portion of that fee is remitted to us for capacity reasons. That's also a longer horizon time, and so we've given specific instructions to PFM for those as well. So each one has its own kind of horizon.
So in other words, does that translate down into that each one of those horizons has different maximum percentage numbers?
Maximum maturity.
Yes,
target.
Maximum maturity.
Maximum maturity, but same allocation factors.
And I would defer to their judgment when it makes sense to use those allocations based on the maturities that we
Which
are
is
seeking.
That's really what I'm getting at, is whether we should do something like that. So.
Yeah, and I would say you know, if you were to look at kind of the makeup of the different funds, it is going to look a little bit different because we manage each of the three as its own separate kind of standalone account. So, for example, we might see more commercial paper in the operating reserve. Just because of the nature of those funds need to be liquid, commercial paper by nature can only go out to 9 months. So that's kind of an example. But in general, they all kind of refer back to the same investment policy, so the same overall asset allocation guidelines.
Thank you. So it sounds like effectively what we do is we do have horizon influenced actual decisions, but it's one policy sitting over all of them, and we design the policy to be flexible enough so that the individual things fit in there. For what it's worth, off the top of my head, that probably makes me a little bit nervous, because what it means is that the policy will be, in sort of our own view, potentially out of whack with the different horizons, because it's an average across all of them, or it has to encompass all of them. But that's a topic for a bigger topic. My last question has to do with the 5% limits on individual issuers that you talked about several times. I think it's great to have limits on individual issuers. One of the things I always worry about with that, and I'm influenced again here by the 2008 scenario, is that tends to sometimes ignore what an engineer would call common mode failures. It's like, you know, you can be no more than 5% in a bunch of issuers, but it turns out behind the scenes the issuers are all exposed to the same risk, and so actually you just bought into that risk in a big way. So how do you manage that, or how do you deal with that in managing the portfolio? And sort of a broader question is 5% too high?
So I will kind of take that. So we do recommend in policy establishing a 5% for an issuer limit, because that's just a little bit easier, you know, to kind of incorporate into an investment policy. But our own credit committee, they have a much more detailed list. So to give you an example, maybe they would say, okay, for this issuer A, we're comfortable with allocating, you know, if it's only commercial paper, maybe 4%. But if it's only long-term notes, maybe only 2%. So our credit committee has a much more detailed list that takes into consideration things like longer-term exposure versus short-term exposure, and they are also kind of making tweaks to who we're actively buying and who we might put on hold. So one example that I would give you, given all the recent trade tensions between the U.S. and China, we took another deep look, not we because I'm not on the committee, but the committee took a deep look at our approved issuer list and said, okay, if things go south, you know, which companies are most exposed and who do we want to say, you know, put this issuer on hold? Don't buy anymore. So again, this kind of speaks to, you know, you're putting the onus on us. You're putting the onus on PFM to kind of be thinking ahead. What could go wrong, and how do we protect our clients' assets? So even though your policy might be a simplified version of that, behind the scenes, there's a lot more work and a lot more number crunching going into it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I'll just have a couple of quick follow-ups. So just to confirm, what we pay PMF is not connected at all to the returns that they get. Right. It's just a question of how much money they are managing for us. Right?
Correct.
I think I've got questions. I have plenty of comments, but I think I'm okay right now then. Thank you.
Would you like to make your comments?
Yeah. Sure. I'm happy to start. So again, as I mentioned, I think, first of all, thank you for bringing this to the committee's, the commission's attention. I think it is definitely a worthwhile topic to be discussed. I was fortunate to get some time with our finance director over the weekend, so I did not have a chance to fully vet the recommendations with him. But I know that he is not yet quite on board with the recommendation. So I know that, you know, and he indicated that you had brought the items to him for discussion. He hasn't seen the final recommendation. So when it comes to investment policy like this, I will say for me on a JPA as Belmont's representative, it would be virtually, I don't want to say impossible, but close to impossible for me to support any change in investment policy like this that didn't have our finance director's blessing. It doesn't have that yet. So I'm certainly willing to continue this discussion to another time, but at least as of today, I don't quite have that feeling. At this point, I would say I'm still not convinced that focusing our energies with LAIF is that much worse than using PFM, which, as I said, we work with, good reputation, no problem. I'm a little bit concerned that the structure of the investment policy was made with the company that would be carrying it out. There's a little bit of conflict of interest in that, and that also kind of concerns me. Now, it may not have been practical to use one agency to help construct the policy and another one to do the investments, but I still have a little bit of trepidation just because of the conflict of interest going on behind this. I am absolutely in agreement with Matt on safety, liquidity, and yield. And personally, I also agree with you, Matt, that I put yield, not to say it's unimportant, but safety is incredibly important. I just cannot stand the, you know, if you will, I think we are highly responsible to make sure we just don't lose the principal. And that's where liquidity obviously comes next, because we need to have the money when we need it. And yield will be what it is, albeit I think the folks at LAIF have done a very, very excellent job. We're managed with a pool of money, and there I know are spending lots of energy and time and doing a very good job on this, albeit the maturity level may be a little different, which also reduces the interest. So with all of that, I'm not at the point where I can support this, the changes there. But again, it's not that I don't think it's a worthwhile discussion item.
Sure. Through the chair.
Yes.
So since I wasn't able to reach my finance director over the weekend, what is Rebecca's view of this?
So the San Carlos finance team is in a situation where you collect your revenues strictly through the county on their tax roll. And the county offers generously to manage those on their behalf. So the county finance pool, or county pool, I think, where they largely leave their money.
About 60-40, but yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's their kind of basic vehicles between the county and LAIF is how they've chosen to do it.
I was aware of how we structure our family. What I meant is, what were their views of this proposal?
Yeah, and I should have followed that up by saying that she's quite content to leave it there. I think she, for reasons that Belmont was echoing, she saw the risk versus the benefit as less attractive for their reasons.
Yeah, you know, I guess the question, probably the overriding question I have that I'm sort of still wrestling with as we're talking here, is it worth making this change for, admittedly, a relatively small sum of money? Mm-hmm. And I absolutely agree with you that over time it will grow and it will compound and stuff, but right. Within the context, I don't want to be cavalier about $250,000, but within the context of a $1 billion program, it's kind
sure.
of like,
there was a question earlier on the finance committee. Can you give us, I know that Kimber from our city is mm-hmm. the controller for this agency.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit just how you arrived at, since we don't have this organization or this board stepping into it this year? I noticed that we don't have like a finance committee, a program committee, and all those others. It's a smaller board. It's a different type of organization. So who gives you this recommendation, how it happens, perhaps that, like, does it work
sure.
with the controller? Is that how you
So in this particular case, we did want to take care to reach out to the member agencies. So when I foresee something that may not have, as apparent of approval, or things that are new, more nuanced in nature, we'll set up these meetings with our finance teams. And I do that probably twice a year. Largely, and this is the case here, that's their feedback will be incorporated into our long-range finance plan. In January, a couple of months, we'll come out with another long-range finance plan, and it predicts or estimates and forecasts what is our cash flow needs over the next 10 years. And in that is incorporated our reserve policy, our investment policy. So I bring all of these policies, and where that influence is best is when we bring those to the commission or to the committee, and then we take that feedback in here. Clearly, this is an issue that not everyone treats the same way, but it's an issue that, from my personal perspective, I value the expertise of Leslie and her team, and I know that I am not equipped to do that. Other cities and members feel like they do have a certain amount of expertise, and they have decades of experience that I may lack. So I'm looking for that guidance. And as I do so, I didn't want to restrict the expert to say, well, I'm not going to give you the latitude to do that. I can see where it's legal, and I can see where you're recommending, but I don't want to oversee and what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to micromanage our experts. And so I felt it was appropriate to at least bring this in with their recommendations. I will say that with their recommendations, I did check, and we have Fieldman Rolapp, who's our investment advisor. They helped me build the long-range finance plan. They're well-versed in this. The Fieldman Rolapp is the firm that put the RFP out on the street. We had PFM, Chandler Investments, a couple other participants. We evaluated their proposals, and Fieldman Rolapp has looked at this language and is comfortable with it. And they have, again, several decades of experience. So I'm trying to incorporate the experience and the balance of varying viewpoints to propose what our policy should be.
Commissioners, how would you like to move forward? This is an action item.
I'm personally not comfortable with this yet. I really would like to have the time to be able to talk to a couple of my folks, the other members of the board, of my board, that have knowledge a lot more than I do in this matter. So can we go vote at this time? I'm a little nervous. Or I'm a lot nervous.
What is the time frame?
This is not urgent. This will inform our long-range finance plan, and given the size of the numbers, we can do it anytime.
Through the chair.
Yes.
Just a comment. Matt, I just want you to understand that I actually very much appreciate you having done the work of bringing this forward, because I think you're in a position of, in a way, almost damned if you do and damned if you don't. I mean, if you don't seek to maximize within safety parameters what's there, some years from now, that you could be sitting in front of a group of people saying, "How come you didn't earn us an extra $250 million?" So I appreciate you doing all this work. It is ultimately the balancing act in a judgment that properly has to come out of the commission. And personally, what I'm leaning towards is promising not to complain to you about not getting that $250 million. So it sounds like we're going to let this one come back at some future date.
But is December enough, or are we comfortable with a meeting with our staffs by December next month?
If it goes south,
with your finance teams and members, if you'd like to have a discussion, both Leslie and myself can make ourselves available for a phone call with any of the members as you need to.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so then we were going to table item 8A until December. And we're moving on to item B.
This gets to be Matt also. Getting a piece of it.
So item 8B, this is our reserve policy. We also brought this back in September to discuss the reserve policy. We did also discuss this with your respective finance members and the technical committee and got some feedback. Generally supportive. There weren't too many questions on this. And so what we are doing is we are proposing to amend the policy to do a couple of things. One is that we want to establish what we think of as an appropriately sized cap. The current policy says your CIP reserve will grow, and it will continue to grow. And in fact, that growth will accelerate because we're going to be giving more money every year per policy. And as that accelerates, you will get to a point where you will be building substantially a certain amount of reserves. And when looking at this, we felt, I don't know that it's appropriate to have a, there is no limit to the amount of money this could grow to. So we're offering that as a $50 million cap, and you'll see that and why we feel that. The second thing we're doing is that we want to balance this between the amount of money we're dedicating to the CFP reserve, cash reserves, and the annual capital improvement expenditures. And if you remember, the CIP here at SBCW became, well, it occurred in such a large and stark way because so many items were being deferred. And we don't want to find ourselves in that situation again. So the shift would be not to, once we finish the current rescue program, not to stop doing anything and wait for the next generation, you know, 20 years afterwards, let's do another big CIP. We would rather have a policy in here to say, let's spend money as needed each year, every year, at an appropriate level to manage those equipment replacements and not let those problems grow until the problem is so gargantuan that we have to borrow a lot of money and address all these broken things. So that, in a nutshell, is what we're proposing here. There were a few slides. I got on a roll. We do have $18 million in the CIP reserve in total, a little bit of which, $2.6 million of which, is restricted, and those restrictions are for SRF. We see here, this is unmodified. The number in the next 20 years, by 2039, could be as much as $150 million or approaching $150 million, and it assumes two things. One, there's no limit. Two, it assumes that we would not spend those monies because in the policy today, there is no explicit reference to say you should pay for this, you should pay for those ongoing capital expenditures out of this fund. There is nothing like that today in the language. And so that's what we'd like to address.
Chair.
Commissioner Albert.
Thank you. So a few questions here, Matt. You touched on this stuff before in earlier discussions, but we keep referring to history at Silicon Valley Clean Water where for a long period of time a lot of necessary work was being deferred. My perspective on that has always been that the political decision-making process chose, I mean, it wasn't like people just were coming into work every day and having commission meetings and not even thinking about it. They chose not to make the investments. Probably, I imagine, to hold down the possibility of sewer rate increases. Okay, is that a reasonable sense?
Yes.
I mean, I know there's a lot of detail in there.
Yes, that is exactly the reason.
I would also offer, anecdotally, a lot of staff or retirees that I've spoken to, they were you know, in their minds, this was a brand new plant, right? Brand new plant, 1980, you know, and by 2000. It was still in some
still
people's minds.
Still a brand new plan.
That's fair. I mean, when we all buy brand new cars, we don't expect the maintenance budget to be the same
right.
in the first few years. And if it is, then we declare the car to be a lemon, right? You know. I guess the issue I've always had with the these reserve policy discussions is I think I understand the motivations to not get into that trap again. Okay, but. That's almost like what we're doing is we're sort of saying, well, we can't trust the individual agencies that this agency, this JPA, serves to do the right thing because they may make bad decisions. And so we're going to squirrel money aside so that we sort of don't have to go back hat in hand to them saying, hey, look, a problem has occurred. Or this year we happen to need $10 million worth of ordinary maintenance, and your share is this, and oh, you don't want to pay it. Well, that's a problem. And fundamentally, I have a problem with that in the sense that it almost feels like I'm working against the interests of the people that I'm representing. Okay, I overall would feel more comfortable with something where instead of building up, and I'm not sure exactly how I write this, but rather than building up reserves at the Silicon Valley clean water level, is to sort of say, allocate out to each of the member agencies, you are on the hook and must take action to say that you're on the hook, that if we call you up for, you know, your share of $10 million next year, you will deliver the money, okay? How you do it, how you come up with it, that's up to you, but you will do it, okay? Because that leaves the control of the money. It doesn't sequester money down here as sort of a second-level JPA. It says the member agencies are obligated to make sure the JPA doesn't fail, which we fundamentally are anyway. Was thought to that kind of approach given, and if so, what are the failures in it? I mean, you know, why would you not go that route?
So I have something. So before 2008, this agency did not have a capital improvement program.
Right.
And I have never been to an agency or a city that didn't have a capital improvement program. So I think that's a fundamental necessity to have, is a capital improvement program. And what Matt's suggesting is that we have a running $10 million CIP program to take care of the things that we need to take care of. I mean, some of the projects we finished in 2008 are recurring now. We need to address them again in the next few years. So it's kind of that Golden Gate Bridge, you know, scenario where you finish one end and then you have to come back to that same end. So whether it sits here at SVCW or in your respective agencies that, you know, we're going to spend $10 million plus or minus a year and we give you an invoice, it's okay. But I would push really hard is we need a capital improvement program from year in and year out. The reserve fund, whether it's $50 million or $20 million or $80 million, that's for things like the DMF pipe that sprung a leak. That's for things that are unexpected that I don't know if the member agencies want to carry that kind of risk of all of a sudden they need to pony up, you know, $10 million or $20 million to fix something. And that's obviously up to you, but that's just some of the thoughts I have as I hear you speaking.
I've been, in my previous life, I was in another agency where I was on that side of the table. And we had a large JPA, State Water, who was, you know, constantly asking for, in our minds, more money. I also, as we as a smaller agency were issuing debt, there was a constant look at, well, how much cash reserves do you have? And there was a political amount of pressure that we had to face to say, why are your cash reserves associated? There would be a ratio of cash reserves per your assets on your balance sheet. So none of SVCW is on the members' balance sheets. This is on our balance sheets. So there would be a disassociation there if those reserves were to be held at the member level, where we would look, from a credit perspective, a little bit weakened on SVCW side because we wouldn't have appropriate reserves to manage ourselves going forward. If we were to point to a policy, good. If we could point to a restricted amount of money, whether it's held at the member level, better. Best scenario is we can point to something in the name of the agency that is preserved by policy and managed. I think that's what the proposal is.
If I may, one other question. Actually, Warren may be the person to answer this one. My recollection is that certain expenditures either are financed different, paid for differently by individual agency. I seem to remember there was something that like San Carlos paid for through fees that you guys paid for through some other mechanism. In other words, the JPA structure itself allows some flexibility in how obligations of the JPA are funded. But maybe I'm hallucinating about that. You're looking like I really have no idea what I'm saying.
I'm not 100% sure. Okay. I fully get it, but there are places where certainly Belmont has not participated in certain of the loans because we've raised the money and we've paid it directly as opposed to doing that. So, yes.
Thank you. That was exactly it. So,
to that end, that's this last loan is we paid for that with our own cash reserves half of it rather than participate in the loan amount.
Whereas I think San Carlos actually participated in the loan. Conceptually, I know that's a very, conceptually that seems like a valuable model to follow in the reserve space too. That it doesn't have to all be met the same way. Because I think you made a really good, or Teresa made a really good point, that some agencies might not want to have to sit there and go, well, we may get the phone call saying, we need that $3 million. And maybe we should accord them the flexibility of saying, yes, we would like to send you some money every year and stick it in an account, and that's our share of that. But other agencies may not.
I would think that this agency should have the reserves that are associated with its specific needs in line with the capital improvement program. Because I think this board needs to be able to make a decision to say we need to move forward with this project and use that money and have it immediately on tap, just the way we manage our reserves in a way that this is depicting. So I would think that we should have the reserves here to do the projects that need to be done here. I think that makes a lot more sense.
So I'm hearing that. So but we would like to make a motion on item 8B?
Maybe related to this is $50 million is a nice number. If it's in the policy, it's perpetuated forever. The previous policy, while a little out of control, it has no limit, but 50 million 10 years from now, 50 million isn't, you know, maybe the equivalent of 10. So what takes up the, how do we manage that?
This is a policy we visit every year, and every year we would bring forward, here's our recommendations. In the policy, there's not a CPI, you know, increase or an ENR, engineer news record, sort of increase-based, you know, metric, which we could easily incorporate if that was the preference. But right now, $50 million is in the number that engineering felt like that would address a substantial failure of, say, a pump station or something to keep us able to fund that without having to immediately go to the members to...
Can I suggest that the policy include a statement that during the annual review, the maximum limit would be specifically reviewed in light of something? Mm-hmm. You know, so that...
New again, information.
we got caught by not spending anything. Well, now we have something, but in 10 years, we should have the same, whatever cushion we think we have, we're thinking is necessary, it should be perpetuated.
That's a good idea.
Through the chair, I think the point George raises is actually quite a good one and important. And Matt, you mentioned that it might not be too difficult to include some type of a CPI adjustment factor. I mean, if we were to vote and pass this today, could we do so with including some type of CPI adjustment? Because I, from my perspective, number one, the good news is, so to speak, this isn't even expected to come into play for another 10 years. So we have the luxury of review. My experience, which may not match the others, commissioners, but my experience is that when you have something and now commissioners are reviewing it in future years, it's sometimes much easier to work from that than kind of add that later. Why wasn't it added? So I'd much rather 5 years from now, if with the CPI adjustments it's too high, then you know there wants to be an adjustment, great. Whatever the commission can do that. But I think from our perspective, it might be good to plan. From a purely practical matter, I also agree that I think it is good to have the reserves here. I know that even from Belmont, there are certain timing issues. If we have to raise money with raising rates, et cetera, there are certain timing requirements, and I think the agency is better off having the access to the money, because and I'm going to use Redwood City for the moment, so Alicia, please forgive me for this. Mm-hmm. But if Redwood City's funds were not here deposited with the agency, and something comes up, and the Redwood City representative, I apologize because I know this would never happen, but the Redwood City then representative, from a practical matter, kind of thinking, okay, is the political willpower to do this? Maybe we can get away without making the change from SCD. All of a sudden, lots of other factors may start coming into play. That's all. Not saying they will or they won't. They could. So I think from a practical matter, it is nice to have a policy here. I could see how this agency was working without the reserves, and it was not good. Whether or not, you know, and I think the notion of capping it at 50 million plus or minus, it's a reasonable one, and I think it actually, what you've got here puts the agency in a much stronger position to carry out the work that it needs to carry out.
Can I ask another question? As we cap it, Is it stated here, and I did read it, but misunderstood it, is that does this say, rather implicitly, that the money we are putting forward for capital will then go to a capital project? Is that part in the vocabulary here?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, that's got it.
And so to clarify, it's not so much it's a cap, if I understand that it is the money can be, once it exceeds that $50 million, that excess amount can be used for other purposes. It doesn't have to be held until some future time.
It's even more than that. It's committed.
It's committed to capital
to
projects.
That
okay.
work.
Yes.
Great.
That's a much stronger to me, and that's what I'm looking for, is that there's a commitment then to spend that money. It is like, if we want to or not. It's, no, we need a capital improvement going. We need capital. We have money allocated.
Yes, that's the way it's written.
Good.
It's dedicated to capital projects. Commissioner.
Sure, thank you. Yeah, I don't think this is an unreasonable proposal. I definitely agree with Teresa's point that operating a giant multi-sector, multi-jurisdiction agency like this without a capital improvement program plan is foolhardy, so I'm glad that we actually have one and hope that we never not have one. Okay. And part of what you know, every year when we vote on adopting budgets that we're actually buying into is a capital improvement plan as well, that year's iteration or aspect of a capital improvement plan, and that's why we separately discuss it and vote on that as well. And I support all of that. I am going to be voting against this proposal just because of the, as I was talking about before, in a general sense, I prefer to keep public money as close to the public that generated the money as can be done. And that's nothing to reflect Silicon Valley Clean Water. I've taken the same position with a number of other JPAs that I've served on over the years. I prefer, for a bunch of reasons, including the fact that I believe it's more transparent that way, more visible to people, because other than Jim Lewis, we rarely have anybody here. But thank you. Good work, and as you said, not an unreasonable policy, just not one I'm going to be supporting.
I'm going to agree with a couple of my colleagues that I think the funding, the CIP, should definitely stay within this organization for a number of reasons. I think that our cities have different budgets, all four of our entities and that in our cities, and I think it's what is $30 million in one for one city could be the majority of their budget, and the way that reflects on what they have in reserves and the way people look at it, it's like, oh, that money is available versus what it really was intended for, and it's confusing, I think, to our clients that we're moving for. So I would like to move that we approve item 8C, if I can get a
8B.
Second. 8B.
Clarification.
Yes.
Does this motion then include the caveat that we put an escalator in there somehow?
Yes, including your escalator.
Thank you.
So I've made a motion.
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
May I make one additional very brief comment?
Yes.
Understand the motivation for it. I'm particularly opposed to the idea of putting an escalator in. I like the earlier language of saying we should review this every year when we review the policy.
Did you?
It wouldn't change my vote either way, Alicia. So thank you for considering that.
So we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed?
Aye. Or nay.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Moving on to item 8C.
This is our latest, greatest emergency condition. This is what we had presumed was our DMF feed pipe, and what we saw was a lot of water at the surface on our west access road. That's the road that you typically drive into, except for today, because we closed it off. This is a, we did a dye test, we did a dye test that was supposed to be a video, but it's not working, so. That proved to us that it was, in fact, the DMF pipe. Where's the mouse? Anyhow. Okay. So we did that on November 7th. We had a diver able to mobilize last Thursday, and they went into the pipe. That's okay. sorry.
Okay.
I just wanted to show where the pipe was in relation to where we injected the dye and where the feed pipe is proper. The pipe is a 66-inch diameter. It's encased in 6 inches of concrete, and it's tied into our main structure base slab. This is the main structure. That whole white section is our main structure. That's on piles. This is a couple pictures of the diver going into the pipe. The pipe comes up. We have DMF feed pipes feeding the pipe. It comes up, goes over, goes down underneath the base slab, and then across to the filters, and then up again. So, and then there's a picture of the diver getting ready to go in.
There's enough room for the diver to turn around.
It's,
I hope.
Yeah, if you're claustrophobic, don't be a diver.
It's
for
a small
surge
diver.
Treatment plant. This is a schematic of what they saw when they went in there. The biggest being a 6-inch hole through the pipe, as well as the concrete encasing the pipe. So, guy stuck his fist through there, and you know he went all the way up to his shoulder. There's some other things that he noticed: blistering. We think that's the coating is blistering. There's some corrosion on the top of the pipe here, which also means that the coating is gone. Pile of coating here, missing coating, pile of debris at the end. So the next steps is evaluate options for a temporary fix. People have been working over the weekend, including Kim talking with the contractor about a temporary fix. They are preparing to go in later this afternoon with a temporary fix, which is great. And then we're going to meet after this commission meeting with contractor as well as some engineering folks to see what we can do for a permanent fix, and I'll report back to the commission next month.
How old is the pipe, Teresa?
It's original construction, so 1980, about 40 years old. It's a steel pipe, welded steel.
Through the chair.
Yes, commission.
A couple of questions. Thank you, Teresa, about how old it was. I was curious about that. Do we have any sense of what caused the, for lack of a better term, the various modes of decay that were seen inside the pipe?
You know, one guess is that perhaps when they were, because this 6-inch encasement has rebar in it, perhaps when they were pouring this, rebar, you know, was touching the pipe, and then you get these
galvanic reactions.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, over the 40 years,
right.
Perhaps it had just, you know, slowly eroded, because it's a very odd place for this hole to occur. It's at 4 o'clock on the clock. Very, very. It's not an area we would have expected.
And not to make light of the situation, but your description originally of how it's set up, it's like, wow, that's like a trifecta of the worst pipe and the worst place and the worst covering. But it leads to my sort of next question. Are there any other, what's the right term, embedded risks like this?
Yes.
And if so, have we been assessing them as part of our plans, and are we reassessing, like maybe we should send divers through more of them, or yeah. assuming
you
they
can
fit? I mean, just in general, you know, this is kind of a wake-up event for GE.
So we have been assessing some other pipes, smaller 24-inch pipes that I don't think even the smallest diver can get into. And we just had a meeting about the pipes the other day. So those were the most at-risk pipes based on our analysis until we started experiencing a lot of water on the West Access Road. So we do have. I forget how this works. Is it this?
It's that. It doesn't show very well on the yeah. light, though.
So we do have some other large diameter pipes that just go between the that go between the various processes and the plant. And we do have a project in the CIP to investigate those. And after this experience, we will be more aggressively. Pursuing getting the divers in the pipes that we are able to get divers into and cameras into the ones that we can.
Okay. And it sounds like this fixing this problem on a permanent basis is potentially a very expensive thing.
Yes, we expect it will be.
Okay.
Care to guess?
No. I do not care to guess.
A lot of times it depends on the access on either side of the pipe, so that can make the method of fixing or lining or whatever these pipes very expensive.
Is there ever I'm sorry, George.
No, it's fine. Go.
Is there ever? How often do we say this just has to be replaced versus patching up? Is there a cycle that you have on? In our CIP that we know in 10 years, I was told the other day, your freezer is going to last 5 more years. Okay, so that's in my budget. The last time we can fix it. So do we have that kind of, within all of our projects that say, check, this one's, kind of what we want PG&E to do and all the others. Is there something like that, or are we just trying to react and fix and things like that?
No, we are trying to get at replacing what needs to be replaced and can be replaced for our main structure, which is concrete with coating. As long as we continue with the recoating of the concrete, it should last well over 100 years, and that's what we're counting on. For steel pipe like this, I think the answer is to probably slip line it, which means put a new pipe inside of the existing pipe if we can get at it and the access is okay. If we can't do that, boy, it'd be, I'm not quite sure what we would do.
Commissioner?
Because this goes underneath the whole structure.
Right.
It's with cathodic, can you tell whether this is internal or external corrosion?
Not at this point.
Okay. And would cathodic protection do us a lot of good on this sort of thing? In fact, more on all of the under... structure piping?
Yeah, I think we need to make our... We used to have cathodic protection on a lot of the pipes in the plant, but those fell by the wayside, and nobody reinstituted. That was before my time, but I think we need to reinstitute that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, particularly in this environment, yeah. It's all a positive, not a cathodic protection, not the galvanic.
Right.
Impressed current. There we go. I'll get the right word. System. This is really tough. Are you also addressing the blistering at this point in time, or is this kind of the big
thing? Right now, we're going to address the 6-inch hole. That's
yes.
what they're doing this afternoon. Yeah. And then the permanent fix, we have to look at the blistering and the missing coatings.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Commissioner Weber.
Thank you. I want to broaden the comment I made earlier to sort of beyond pipes, and I know this could be an open-ended kind of thing, so you're going to have to apply judgment about how far you dig. But it feels like this is sort of a structural kind of design risk because of the way the facility was built originally. I don't know if it would have been possible to make that pipe more accessible when the facility was originally built, but it's not now. And I guess my more general question is, what other potential time bombs do we have sitting around like that? And not because necessarily, hey, we have to replace all of those because we might not be able to, but at least like to know what we're sitting on, okay? And this is kind of, again, a good wake-up call to think about. Mm-hmm. Okay, go back and look at the original designs and go, okay, we might not do that this way. That's a risk that we have to keep in mind.
I think that's kind of my question as well, is like what kind of a capital improvement project lineup do we have with timelines and budgets and, you know, length of all of that. I think maybe if you don't have that, that might be something that we could look at, especially as we look at our finances.
Commissioner. Thank you. So most of my questions were actually asked, so thank you, Commissioner Olbert. I just wanted to kind of just to confirm, with respect to the cameras and the dives, am I to understand that you are going to be giving some thought to whether we look at it once a year, every other year, every 5 years, you'll be thinking about what kind of program we do to see if we can identify these things either in advance or as they're smaller versus larger? That's great.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So I need a motion on item 8C.
Second.
First, a second, and a third. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. Thank you. And I believe now we are moving into closed session. Is that correct?
Yes.
By the way, good job, everybody, responding to a totally unexpected problem.
Yeah. Keeps it interesting.
You know the ancient Chinese curse, which is neither ancient nor Chinese.
What's that?
May you live in interesting times.
Oh, right, yes.
So Greg's here, should I have him way outside?
Mm-hmm. Okay. See how time is. Are you okay on time? Can you wait a little bit?
Yeah, I'll be back.
Yes. Let me know. I would require his name or announce his name on 9C&D. Because I'm going to have Matt in here also.
For the two real property? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just for future reference, and maybe I'll make a statement then again after the Brown Act requires that the negotiators that are present in the closed session be named.
I see. Okay.
So, and I should have asked, I was going to ask you, but I didn't, but in any way.
I mean, they don't have to be, but I thought it'd be useful.
Oh, I agree. No, it's fine. It's just a procedural requirement.
Okay, ready? Mm-hmm. Or are we waiting for?
No, we're ready.
Okay. So let's start with item 9A. It's already 943. I want to be
Where in the mountains?
North of Truckee, about 38 miles.
Oh,
is it actually
Sierra?
Gray Eagle.
I've been trying to sell it after since Pete passed, and I just. That's a hard.
Maybe we should talk.
Yeah.
It's on a golf course. It's beautiful.
You can't sell it, so I'll make it.
It's beautiful. It's on a golf course.
Okay, so we have to.
Okay, we're good?
Open session.
Do a report out?
Yes, thank you, Madam President. As to closed session items 9A through D, no reportable action was taken and direction was given to staff.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
All in favor.
Okay.
Aye.
Okay, we'll see you next month.
You need to sign.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.